We're in 2 Chronicles chapter 19 now in our study, as we're studying about King Jehoshaphat over Judah. So he was one of the kings of Judah and is actually the fourth king of Judah, since the kingdom was divided after Solomon died. Solomon's son Rehoboam was the first king over Judah, along with the tribe of Benjamin. The other tribes followed Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and made him their king. And those 10 tribes of the north have been following other kings since then that have all been wicked, up to the time in our study now where we've been looking at the reign of King Ahab over Israel, who just died from the account that we have in 2 Chronicles 18 in that battle in Ramoth in Gilead. And Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, went to help him in that battle, which was not a good thing. After Rehoboam, Abijam was the next king of Judah. Rehoboam, after 3 years, departed from the Lord during his reign. And then Abijam, he was a hypocrite. He claimed to love the Lord and claimed to be doing his will, but he didn't. So what he said and what he did were not the same. He did not keep God's commandments. Then his son Asa, Jehoshaphat's father, was a righteous man. So he was the first of the kings of Judah since the division of the kingdom that was righteous and didn't depart from the Lord's commandments all of his days. And his son Jehoshaphat, we've seen God's testimony that he is a righteous man and has many good things in him and good things that he has done up to this point in our study and would continue to do throughout his reign and his life. He did make a grave mistake in marrying his son Jehoram to Ahab's daughter, to Athaliah, so he joined together his family with that of Ahab, who was the most wicked king that Israel had. So that was a grave error that he committed. And then as a part of what went along with that is he faced constant temptation then with that family tie now to go along with and to be involved with those wicked people that were now his son's in-laws. Not that Jehoshaphat himself followed after their wicked ways, the Lord had pointed that out, that he didn't do those things himself, but he should have had no dealings, no involvement with, no fellowship or partnership with that wicked family. Yet he went with Ahab to help him to try to get Ramoth and Gilead back, which God had taken from his hands because of Ahab's wickedness. And so at the beginning of chapter 19, God sent that prophet Jehu, the son of Hanani, to rebuke him for trying to help the ungodly and loving this man who hated the Lord, Ahab. And so God was angry with him for that, it said in verse 2. But then the prophet pointed out the good that was in Jehoshaphat and how he had prepared his heart to seek God. And so he was a righteous man who had fallen to a temptation. But the devil's not going to quit tempting him with this. And he's going to continue to battle with this, and he's going to have some more failures along these same lines in the future. But God's going to keep working with him to overcome this. Otherwise, Jehoshaphat, we see in his life so much good that he did because he did prepare his heart to seek God. And we spent a good bit of time on that last week. In contrast to Rehoboam, who departed from the Lord, and it says he did evil because he prepared not his heart to seek the Lord. So that's a very key point that we all need to learn. It was the difference between what caused Rehoboam to depart from the Lord and what kept Jehoshaphat steadfast in obeying the Lord. We have to prepare our hearts to seek him. Otherwise, we're not going to find, and we will not be, we will not please him. But Jehoshaphat did. So then we were reading from verse 4 last time, where he appointed judges, and we read verses 4 through 7, which we will read again here for a moment, because we didn't get to dig into that very much at the end of our time last week. But 2 Chronicles chapter 19, verses 4 through 7 says, "And Jehoshaphat dwelt at Jerusalem, and he went out again through the people from Beersheba to Mount Ephraim, and brought them back unto the Lord God of their fathers." So there is yet another example of Jehoshaphat's goodness. He was not content merely to follow God himself. He had a zeal for all of God's people to be following him, and certainly the ones who were his subjects that were under the authority he had as the king. And so he was taking measures to bring back the ones who hadn't been serving him. And it mentions up to Mount Ephraim. Mount Ephraim, now it didn't include up to it, but what Mount Ephraim was whose territory? I mean, that was the heart of the territory of the northern kingdom. So he's referring to territory that, going back to Asa's time and what we read in chapter 17 of 2 Chronicles at the beginning of Jehoshaphat's reign, there were cities that had been in part of the territory of the northern kingdom of Israel that had been taken by Judah back in the time when Baasha tried to build strongholds to use to go and invade and threaten Judah. And so those were then conquered by Asa, and Jehoshaphat built them up. So he has some control over some cities and territory that actually had belonged to that northern kingdom. Well, what did Jehoshaphat do with those people that were there? Now, of course, thinking about it, up until the time where they came under dominion of the kings of Judah, what had they been doing? Well, they had been under those kings of the north, and as such, were they in a position where they were to be able to follow the Lord and keep his commandments? They were forbidden from it by the kings of Israel. Going back to Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, their first king, he made up a new religion to prevent them from going to Jerusalem like God commanded. That was the place the Lord had chosen and commanded them, all the people, all of his people, to go three times a year for the sacrifices. Well, Jeroboam didn't want them going there. He thought that would cause them to turn their hearts back to following Rehoboam, and then they would reject him, in spite of God's assurance and promise that he was going to make his kingdom sure if he would follow the Lord. Well, he didn't believe that, and so that's been a problem ever since then, and it was only made worse through the reign and time of Omri and now Ahab having turned the nation to following Baal. So what had many done that were in that the territory of the northern kingdom when being there, living there, made it impossible for them to follow God? What had many of them done to solve that problem? The ones who did love the Lord that were there, well, they left. And they moved themselves, forsook their inheritance. They moved themselves south to be under Judah so that they could still follow God. And there had been a wave of them early on after Rehoboam had become king, and they strengthened his kingdom. We saw there was more of that during Asa's reign. So what is Jehoshaphat now doing with the ones that are in the territory that was of the northern kingdom that he has control over now? He's making sure all of them know the Lord's way. So he's taking great effort to teach the people, to have them to know God's ways and to follow his ways. and to bring back to him the ones who had not, that he now had opportunity to restore. We had read back in chapter 17 that he, when he first became king, he appointed men to go and with the Levites to teach the word of God, his law, throughout all the kingdom. Well, we would know that is something that has continued on. So he's taken measures to make sure that God's word is taught throughout his kingdom. Now he's taking additional measures to bring back to God the ones throughout the entire territory that he ruled over to make sure that they were brought back to the Lord. Then verses 5 through 7 says, "And he set judges in the land throughout all the fenced cities of Judah, city by city, and said to the judges, take heed what you do, for you judge not for man, but for the Lord which is with you in the judgment. Wherefore now let the fear of the Lord be upon you. Take heed and do it, for there is no iniquity with the Lord our God, nor respect of persons, nor taking of gifts." Well, teaching God's word was a vital activity or exercise that needed to be doing, needed to be done. And so he had these teachers around to do that. But how well are things going to go if you have people to teach everybody what God's law is, but the ones that are in the position as judges aren't following that law in the judgment? How well would things go if that were the case? Well, you would have the right teaching, but then you wouldn't have it being applied and practiced by the ones who are actually in authority to exercise judgment over the people. How well is that going to go for the land? That wouldn't be good at all. So Jehoshaphat has the teachers out there, but he's also putting the judges in place so that they could judge according to God's law to make sure that what was being taught was being followed and practiced and judged throughout the land. So he's covering all aspects of this and doing very well in setting up his kingdom for the people to know the Lord, to be able to follow his ways, and for righteousness to be reigning in the land. And we read things like this, and as God's people today, of course, we're not in... this was a special circumstance under the Old Testament when God had made a covenant with a physical nation, which foreshadowed the spiritual nation that we are as God's church today. He's not made a covenant with a physical nation. We don't have a parallel with this from the standpoint, well, the Old Testament law was it was their religious law, but it was also the civil law to govern their nation. And Jehoshaphat is making sure that's being done. Here in our nation today is the United States of America. Is that going to be synonymous with God's spiritual kingdom, his church, where they're one and the same? No. Nevertheless, the Lord does command us in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verses 1 through 4. He wants us to pray to God for the authorities in the land, doesn't he? He commands us to pray to God that it's mainly for whose standpoint or for whom does God command us to make that request for? Well, it's for us, those of us that are servants of the Lord, Christians, that we would be able to live quiet and peaceable lives in all godliness and honesty. Now, is that easy to do if there is anarchy and chaos, if there is no law and order, if there's no if you're not safe in the streets or going about in places and all of that, is that going to enhance and enable and help us to be able to live our lives as God's people, as Christians, like the Lord intends, or would that be a hindrance? I mean, it would. There's a reason why the Lord has all authority in heaven and in earth, and is Lord of all, and exercises authority in the kingdoms or the nations of men, He sets up the rulers and the laws, and he's in control of those things, and that's for good reason. But a big part of that is how it impacts us and the lives that we can live. The kind of judges that are in the land, is that going to make a difference in that? It certainly does. And whether wickedness is given the opportunity to prevail, or whether it's going to be, whether the judges are going to be exercising their judgment in a way that it will be something that would be helpful to us in the lives that we need to live as Christians, which is going to also involve our trying to teach in others the gospel of Christ who don't know him. So the better rulers and judges that we have, the better it is. God has said that and has commanded us to ask him for that, because he's the one that can change those things. But we can see what he says about what Jehoshaphat said when he appointed those judges city by city. He told them to take heed what they were doing, because they were judging not for man but for the Lord who was with them in the judgment. And it sure would be a blessing if that was the mind of all of our judges today, that they were attempting to exercise the judgment in accordance with the will of God. It so happens, I think we all know what's inscribed. I don't know if you've ever seen the Supreme Court of the United States, the building or whatever, but you probably, if you haven't been there, you've probably seen pictures of, or at least aware of, what's inscribed on the walls of the building, but it has the Ten Commandments on there. From a religious point about being under the, we're not under the Ten Commandments per se today, that being the law of Moses, which we're not under now, we're under the law of Christ. But of course, nine of those commandments, if not verbatim, in principle, are taught in the New Testament as part of the law of Christ, the Sabbath day being an exception. But why is that inscribed on the walls of the highest court of our land? It's an acknowledgement that that's where God's judgment is supposed to be exercised. So at least there was a time when that was recognized, that that would be the proper aim of the judges of our nation, to exercise judgment that would be righteous in accordance with the will of God. So it would be good if we saw more of that. But we can ask the Lord for that. But Jehoshaphat said the right thing for the judges that he was appointing there, that they were to judge for the Lord. This was not something for man's sake. They were to be doing the will of God. And God would be with them in the judgment if they were, and there's that principle again, that Jehoshaphat had violated when he allied himself with Ahab. But those who are with the Lord is with them. There's that principle of fellowship again, and partnership that needs to be with God based upon walking in the light, which is also the basis of our having fellowship one with another. And we looked at that last time from 1 John chapter 1, verses 5 through 7, as we were looking at this principle. And then as he also put it in Amos 3 and verse 3, when he said, "Can two walk together except they be agreed?" Well, Jehoshaphat is expressing the understanding of these judges were, if they were drawing near to God, God would draw near to them. If they were following him, walking in the light, God would be with them in that judgment. Now, if they were taking bribes, if they were respecting faces, if they were doing those things, would God be with them in the judgment in that? No. But there was no such, there's nothing like that in God, which was his point in verse 7. And if they were judging according to God's judgment, righteous judgment, they wouldn't be doing those things either. And if they were seeking the Lord's judgment, would he be with them in their judgment? Yes, he would guide them. He would bless them and be with them in that, which is the right point in teaching that he's given there. And he's giving them the correct charge as he's sending them out to exercise judgment. Now, this is really following right along the lines of what we saw back in Exodus chapter 18. after the children of Israel, after the exodus from Egypt, and the children of Israel had entered into that wilderness, having been delivered from their bondage in Egypt. And who was their judge? Who was the first judge of Israel? Well, it was Moses. And we see that on display here in Exodus chapter 18. He was the judge. He was the prophet that the Lord was using to guide them and lead them. So he was the leader of the people, God's people, from this time of coming out of Egypt through the rest of his days. But in Exodus 18 and verse 13, did Moses in that position, did he have to exercise judgment? Did he? He was the judge. I mean, he was the top. So in verse 13 it says, "It came to pass on the morrow that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood by Moses from the morning unto the evening. And when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did to the people, he said, What is this thing that thou doest to the people? Why sittest thou thyself alone, and all the people stand by thee from morning unto even? And Moses said unto his father-in-law, Because the people come unto me to inquire of God. When they have a matter, they come unto me, and I judge between one and another, and I do make them know the statutes of God and his laws." So when Moses was serving as judge, what was he doing? He was doing exactly what Jehoshaphat was telling his judges to do. Did Moses understand he was not for man but for God? He was. And so his whole motive there was for them to make the people, the people of Israel, to know the statutes of God and his laws. Well, then Moses' father-in-law told him in verse 17, he said, "The thing that thou doest is not good. Thou wilt surely wear away both thou and this people that is with thee, for this thing is too heavy for thee. Thou art not able to perform it thyself alone. Hearken now unto my voice. I will give thee counsel, and God shall be with thee. But thou for the people to Godward, that thou mayest bring the causes unto God. And thou shalt teach them ordinances and laws, and shalt show them the way wherein they must walk, and the work that they must do. Moreover, thou shalt provide out of all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands and rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties and rulers of tens. And let them judge the people at all seasons, and it shall be that every great matter they shall bring unto thee, but every matter, small matter, they shall judge. So shall it be easier for thyself, and they shall bear the burden with thee." So it says in verse 24 that Moses hearkened to his father-in-law. And then in verse 25, he chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. And they judged the people at all seasons. The hard causes they brought unto Moses, but every small matter they judged themselves. But what was key there? I mean, the other judges that Moses appointed in the land were ones who feared the Lord. They hated covetousness. They weren't going to take bribes. They weren't going to respect faces. They were not going to pervert judgment, but they were going to judge like what Jehoshaphat instructed his judges to do. So this was the way it was set up in the beginning for the nation. And so Jehoshaphat is following that same pattern, but what he was telling the people to do in their judgment, what he was telling and instructing the judges to do, was in accordance with that. Well, God had also given commandment for the judges in his law in Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 15. He says, "Ye shall do no unrighteousness in judgment. Thou shalt not respect the person of the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty, but in righteousness shalt thou judge thy neighbor." So favoring one over another on the basis of physical things, the way one looked or one's standing or status, how their wealth or any of that, to judge according to those outward things by the appearance. Well, that would be wicked judgment. That's respecting faces, the physical or outward. So that would not be righteous judgment. God doesn't judge that way. And God commanded the people of Israel not to do any unrighteousness in their judgment and not to respect persons in their judgment, but judge their neighbor in righteousness. In fact, if it's only three verses down from this where the second greatest commandment was of the law is found, when he said to love thy neighbor as thyself. And Jesus said that all the law and the prophets hung upon those two, the first and second commandments, to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. Well, that commandment about judging, can we not see how that is an offshoot or a function of loving God and loving one's neighbor to exercise righteous judgment like that? So it should be very easy to see how that commandment of verse 15 hung upon what he goes on to say in verse 18, and what he taught in the greatest commandment in loving God. In the book of Proverbs, in chapter 16 and verse 10, Proverbs, there's a lot about judgment in the book of Proverbs, but just to look at a couple of verses there. In chapter 16 and verse 10, he says, "A divine sentence is in the lips of the king. His mouth transgresseth not in judgment." So when Jehoshaphat said that God would be with them in the judgment, those that are seeking to do the Lord's will, is God going to be there with them for their judgment? Well, he's the one that's ultimately in control and authority there. Can he even use an unrighteous judge to judge righteously? Well, Jesus used an example of that with the importune woman that kept beseeching an unrighteous judge for judgment. She was, and she received it because she wearied him. Of course, Jesus was teaching the point to us not to faint when we pray, but that we need to keep praying and asking the Lord, who is the ultimate, most righteous of all judges. But in Proverbs 20, verse 8, he says, "A king that sitteth in the throne of judgment scattereth away all evil with his eyes." Well, that's the way it's supposed to be. And we can see that Jehoshaphat was instructing the judges that he appointed in the land to follow that. And so he was doing what was going to serve his kingdom very well. And so he has the teachers set up. He has the judges set up. Then going back to 2 Chronicles 19, verse 8, he says, "Moreover, in Jerusalem did Jehoshaphat set of the Levites and of the priests and of the chief of the fathers of Israel for the judgment of the Lord and for controversies when they returned to Jerusalem. And he charged them, saying, Thus shall you do in the fear of the Lord, faithfully and with a perfect heart. And what cause soever shall come to you of your brethren that dwell in their cities, between blood and blood, between law and commandment, statutes and judgments, ye shall even warn them that they trespass not against the Lord. And so wrath come upon you and upon your brethren. This do, and ye shall not trespass. And behold, Amariah the chief priest is over you in all matters of the Lord, and Zebediah the son of Ishmael, the ruler of the house of Judah, for all the king's matters. Also the Levites shall be officers before you. Deal courageously, and the Lord shall be with the good." So that's how Jehoshaphat was organizing his kingdom, and we can see it was for the spiritual good of the nation. Other points there. What would the judges have to do, according to what we're reading there, for them not to be guilty of trespass? Well, they would have to issue the warning to the people, warn them that they trespass not against the Lord. And he said, "And so wrath come upon you and upon your brethren. This do, and ye shall not trespass." So what would the judges have now? If the people are transgressing God's laws and they're having to judge that, well, if the people aren't following the law, well, that's what the judgment is for, to be against them for the evil they're doing and their trespasses. And the Lord would charge, hold the ones who were guilty to be accountable for that. But what does he say? could the judges themselves end up being held accountable to God for being guilty of iniquity? Yes, if they were not doing what? If they were not warning the people, according to God's law, of what the iniquity was. So that was an important principle. It's one that we still have to follow also. Ezekiel chapter 3, when the Lord was working with Ezekiel there, Ezekiel chapter 3 and in verse 16 says, "It came to pass at the end of 7 days that the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, I have made thee a watchman unto the house of Israel. Therefore hear the word at my mouth and give them warning from me. When I say unto the wicked, Thou shalt surely die, and thou givest him not warning, nor speakest to warn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life, the same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at thine hand. Yet if thou warn the wicked, and he turn not from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity, but thou hast delivered thy soul. Again, when a righteous man doth turn from his righteousness and commit iniquity, and I lay a stumbling block before him, he shall not die. He shall die, because thou hast not given him warning. He shall die in his sin, and his righteousness which he hath done shall not be remembered, but his blood will I require at thine hand. Nevertheless, if thou warn the righteous man that the righteous sin not, and he doth not sin, he shall surely live, because he is warned. Also thou hast delivered thy soul." So there's that principle, and that's the same one Jehoshaphat's referring to there. If the judges, the ones in authority to judge, didn't give the warning to the people, and then they fell into iniquity, when they are in a position of responsibility to give that warning, would God hold them accountable? Yes. But if they give the proper warning, would they be held accountable for the people who didn't heed the warning? The answer is no. The same is true for all of us today, in any position of authority we have. Now, if parents don't bring their children up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, if they don't train them in his ways and teach them the Lord's ways, and then the children don't follow God's ways, the children are going to answer for their choices, because even if parents don't give the proper teaching to their children and training, is that the only means by which children would know they have a maker that they need to seek and follow? We all have his eternal power and godness is revealed to us all by the things that are made. So we all know we have a creator, and it's all of our responsibility to seek him, to glorify him as God. So even if somebody doesn't teach us that, God has still made himself known to us in that way. So we're all responsible. That's why he says in Romans 1:21 that we're without excuse. Nobody's going to have the excuse, "Well, my mother or my father, they didn't teach me like they should have, and that's why I was ignorant, and it's not my fault." And how many people blame their parents for when they got problems in their lives, and they blame it on their parents for what they're not doing right? The parents may be held accountable, and will be, if they haven't taught their children, but nobody has an excuse, and we can't blame somebody else for our choice if we do not seek God and serve him. However, from the standpoint of the parents, if they do train them in the Lord's ways and the children don't listen, is God going to blame the parents? No, he won't. But if they don't do that, if they don't bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, will they have to answer to God for that? And the answer is yes. We also have the responsibility. We've been given the commandment by Christ to go into all the world and make disciples of all nations. If we're not, when we give the opportunity, or when the Lord gives us the opportunity as an example, or to give an answer to those who ask a reason of the hope that is in us, to be involved in the teaching of his word, if we don't use that opportunity, will we be responsible before God for that? Yes. But when we're taking those opportunities God gives us, and we are attempting, if we're to shining as the lights in the world, and we're giving the answer to those who ask the reason of the hope that's in us. We're taking the opportunities to try to spread his gospel in whatever ways we have the opportunity to do so. If we're doing all of that, but people don't listen, I mean, are we going to be held accountable for the outcome of that? Well, was Noah a bad preacher because only seven others, his family, his wife, his three sons, and their wives, were saved, were in the ark with him? I mean, he spent 100 years building the ark. Is that all he did with that time for a century, was just build, or did he preach and warn? Well, he's referred to in 2 Peter chapter 2 as a preacher of righteousness. Now, to God, one might say, well, here was a man that was responsible for preaching to this wicked world, and nobody listened, so he must have been a terrible preacher. Well, man may judge that way, but how does God judge? He preached, and he preached the truth. The fact that the people wouldn't listen, was that against Noah? That wasn't against Noah. He preached righteousness. The ones who didn't listen, they'll be judged for that. But that's the principle that Jehoshaphat was teaching these judges here. They needed to warn the people. And if they gave the proper warning and taught them to follow God, and that's what they were doing in their judgment, then if the people wouldn't listen and don't follow it, well, they'll be judged for their iniquity, but God would not charge the judges with trespass. Then he also, we can see that he had everything organized and set up for all of this to be done God's way in his kingdom. So chapter 19 is really fits well with chapter 17 in giving the details of how this righteous king organized his kingdom to make sure that God's word was taught, was known, and followed by everyone in the kingdom. An excellent example Jehoshaphat is in all of that. All right, well, then we get to chapter 20 now in 2 Chronicles. As we look at this chapter, 2 Chronicles chapter 20, we're going to see three of the neighbors of Israel ganging up to fight against Jehoshaphat. And it's going to be the neighbors Moab, Ammon, and Edom. Now those three alone, and those three unlike all the other neighbors, I mean, how many neighbors did Israel have? Well, we know they had the Philistines on the Mediterranean coast that had been there. They had the Phoenicians, Tyre and Sidon to their north, and Syria. They had those immediate neighbors, and we know that there were problems and conflict with all of that. We've seen that, in fact, very recently in our study. I mean, who did Ahab marry? She was the daughter of one of those Phoenician kings, Ethbaal. And so she had been brought up as a Baal worshiper, and then Ahab married her, and she brought Baal worship into Ahab's kingdom, and then it was spread throughout that kingdom. Now, sadly, because this righteous Jehoshaphat has had his son to marry into that, what's going to end up happening in Judah? Well, Judah itself is going to be overrun with Baal worship on account of that. So that's going to happen. But that was the result of the involvement with those Phoenicians to the north. And how much have we seen about the Philistines in our study? But even more recently, who had taken those cities? You remember Ben-Hadad, the king, and fought against Israel and had taken cities and land for them. Ramoth and Gilead, for example, that was Syria. So Syria has been a recent problem there as a neighbor for Israel. So we've seen a lot of these. But what's unique about those three that we're going to be reading about here in 2 Chronicles 20, Moab, Ammon, and Edom? those three, were people, they were relatives of the Israelites. They were cousins. Well, the nations of Moab and Ammon. Moab and Ammon, those were the names of two children that were born to Lot by his daughters. So they were, those were two nations descended from Lot. Edom was the nation descended from whom? Esau, who was Jacob's brother. So these are the descendants of Lot and Esau. So this is, these are directly connected to the children of Israel from their history and their blood. And God had given the territory for Moab, Ammon, and Edom for their inheritance. And you may recall that when Israel came up out of the wilderness, what did God tell them regarding those nations and their land? That was different than what he told them about all those Amorites that dwelt in Canaan. He told us, he commanded the Israelites, all of those nations that were those Amorite nations in Canaan, he told, commanded Israel to utterly destroy all of them. They didn't obey. They didn't fully do that, which became a plague and a problem for them, well, all the way through up to the present time that we're studying. As we know, David, when he became king, had to drive the Jebusites out of Jerusalem. They were still there after all those years, 500 years basically, had been allowed to dwell in that city right in their midst. Well, David finally, when he had the authority and had the opportunity to do so, made sure that commandment was obeyed concerning them. But the other tribes had not driven out some of those people that God had commanded them to utterly destroy. The Lord was displeased with them for that. It goes back to the end of the book of Joshua and beginning of the book of Judges with all of that. But God did not permit. In fact, God forbade his people Israel from destroying or taking the territory of Moab, Ammon, and Edom. God had given those that territory for the descendants of Lot and descendants of Esau for them to dwell in. So that made them different than all those other neighbors. Yet here we see these three, and so if there were any of the ones around Israel had actually that we would expect, well, they should love Israel and love those people and be good neighbors. We might think it would be them, but they weren't because they were wicked. But now those three are banding together and are going to be coming against Jehoshaphat here in 2 Chronicles chapter 20. So that's the basic background of what we're going to be seeing in the chapter. But it's going to be another chapter that shows the faith that Jehoshaphat had. He's going to seek God and he's going to trust the Lord and depend upon the Lord for his deliverance here. It should remind us a great deal of what we saw from his father Asa with what happened when Asa had to face that great Ethiopian army back in 2 Chronicles 14. Asa sought the Lord and told the people to trust the Lord that he would give them their victory, and he did. Jehoshaphat is going to follow that pattern here, and he's going to seek the Lord, and he's going to trust the Lord for his deliverance. In fact, God is going to command him not to, to actually go out and fight these people. So there's not going to actually be a fight that involves Jehoshaphat and the children of Judah. God's going to tell them to stand and watch what he was going to do, and he defeated them by turning them against themselves, and they destroyed each other. But that was going to be God's reward to Jehoshaphat's faith, because Jehoshaphat wasn't thinking, I've got to go out here and do this myself. He was trusting the Lord and knew the Lord could give him, even though it was three enemies coming against him, he still knew the Lord was able to give him deliverance and victory in this. and God rewarded him greatly for it. So that's what we're going to see in 2 Chronicles chapter 20, Lord willing. In verse 1 it says, "It came to pass after this also that the children of Moab and the children of Ammon, and with them other beside the Ammonites, came against Jehoshaphat to battle. Then there came some that told Jehoshaphat, saying, There cometh a great multitude against thee from beyond the sea on this side Syria, and behold, they be in Hazazon-Tamar, which is in Gedi. And Jehoshaphat feared and set himself to seek the Lord and proclaimed a fast throughout all Judah." Well, I mean, that would be some fearful news to get. How does Jehoshaphat respond to the news? You've got a huge gang of enemies that are gathered to come against you. He knew he had a big problem. What is his response to the problem? To go and seek the Lord. I mean, that is the right heart. This is a man that God testified early in chapter 19, as we saw, that he prepared his heart to seek the Lord. Well, here it is in action. So his having prepared his heart to seek the Lord, his natural reaction in every situation when something confronts him is to seek God. What is God's will, and asking the Lord to provide the way through whatever the problem is. I mean, what should we be like? I mean, what should we do? I mean, we have the same God that's with us, that was with Jehoshaphat, and we need to do the same. I mean, are we tempted to think that we can do things ourselves, or that we can solve our problems, and we can do this and we can do that? And on our own, how able are we to do anything? How many of our problems, how many situations that confront us, are we able to take care of and do it ourselves? That we, by our talents, our abilities, our sheer force of will, and whatever else, that we can handle that problem and get it done on our own. Nothing. That's what Jesus said in John 15 and verse 5. He said, "Without me, you can do nothing." What about Israel in their history? Remember, after they conquered that great and powerful walled city of Jericho, they didn't have to fight there either, not to get through the walls. They marched around it according to God's commandments, once a day for 6 days, and then seven times on the seventh day. And what did God do with the walls? He made the walls fall down flat. I mean, they didn't have to assault the city. They then went in after the God made the walls fall down and destroyed all the inhabitants except Rahab's family, as at God's commandment. And remember when five kings of the Amorites came against Joshua in the book of Joshua in chapter 10? And that was when God made the sun and the moon stand still after giving them a great victory to provide more daylight so that fewer of them could escape. And on that day, not only did God make the sun and moon stand still in that situation when it was five kings against Joshua, but they slaughtered them. But actually, who killed the most of those enemies that day? Directly, God did with those hailstones. He killed more with the hailstones than the Israelites did with their swords. So that's another chapter example where God was fighting for Israel, but demonstrated that they didn't need their own power. In fact, it was only with the Lord, but they could prevail against anything with him. But when they went to fight against that little Ai in Joshua in chapter 7, and they didn't ask God ahead of time. In fact, they didn't bring the whole army. They just sent a little bit. We can go handle this a little. We just finished knocking off big old Jericho. Here's this little tiny Ai. Here, you few just go in there and take care of that and conquer that one for us. Well, how did that go? They fell in defeat to that little Ai. Of course, it had to do. God wasn't with them because that Achan had taken of the accursed things of Jericho and had it in their midst. And so that was at the heart of that. But if they had been asking the Lord before they went to that battle, I mean, they would have known they would have gone in defeat, and he would have told them not to go. But they clearly didn't ask him. They were in the mindset, well, this is a small thing, we can handle that. But how much were they able to do? How many of those cities in Canaan, even a little one, could they manage and conquer on their own without the Lord? None. Not even a little smallest one. But with the Lord, they conquered all of it. But what is taught by all those examples and also by Jehoshaphat here? I mean, it's the same principle. And if we're facing in our lives whatever we face day by day, and we're out there thinking we're doing it on our own, and we're not asking the Lord for his help through those things, what's liable to happen? Well, we're liable to end up with a big mess, because we sure can't do anything without him. The other side, of course, Philippians 4, verse 13, what can we do with Christ who strengthens us? He says all things. So we can do nothing without him. We can do all things with him. So are we going to seek him and rely upon him and ask for his help, or are we going to try to do it on our own? Well, it should seem very obvious which way we should choose, like Jehoshaphat did here. But we do remember a couple times where even Joshua, as righteous as he was, that slipped his mind. And so he had a couple problems. So it can happen to us too. So we need to train ourselves, prepare our hearts to seek the Lord, so that in every situation, big or small, that we're seeking him, that we're asking him, depending upon him, and our faith is in him, not in ourselves, trusting in ourselves. We'll read further with this in chapter 20, Lord willing, next Sunday morning. Do appreciate everybody who's able to be here and able to listen in, we trust the Lord will give us that opportunity again next Sunday morning to continue with our study here. But we're going to close now in prayer.